WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A few weeks ago, our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviewed the debut CD of clarinetist and composer Andy Biskin. We liked the music so much, we started playing it on the show. Then we decided to invite Biskin to talk with us about it. As Kevin said, Biskin's compositions recall early jazz and old social music. Short solos alternate with tightly arranged passages, the rhythm section sometimes plays two-beat oompa rhythms, and his quintet has a trumpet, clarinet, and trombone front line like an old New Orleans jazz band. Even so, the sound he gets from those old ingredients is quite fresh. Biskin's new CD, Dogmental, is on GM Records, the label founded by composer and conductor Gunther Schuller, who praises Biskin's originality and sophisticated humor. Here's Biskin's composition, Sad Commentary. Things you do as an arranger and composer that I like is that, you know, you take the tune that you wrote and you very quickly put it through different distortions and permutations. In fact, you know, I was listening to your record while watching the timer just to see, like, because I sometimes do that for the show. We might play a minute or a minute and a half or something. And by the time you're like 40 seconds into one of your tracks, it's often gone through like two or three different permutations.
I think I'm approaching composition as an improviser because I spent a lot of time improvising before I ever attempted to write music. And when I'm writing music, I try to be in that sort of mindset where you just write down the first thing that comes into your head. You know, maybe I actually, if I'm looking for the next thing to do, I just start playing the song and say, well, if I was playing a solo on this song, what would I do next? And so I try to capture that spontaneity and then fix it on paper.
I'm interested too in the speed in which the changes happen. I mean, it's what can I say? Short attention span music in the best sense of the word.
Yeah, I agree. And I am maybe because I have a short attention span, and I go hear a lot of music, and I get bored. I'm really happy at the beginning of the tune when you're hearing the stuff that was written out, and then there's all these long solos, and I'm kind of wishing that more stuff was written out. So I guess I'm catering to someone like me that's sitting in the audience that wants things to keep changing. And in the old days, people probably could concentrate for much longer, but not me.
In the liner notes for your new CD, you talk about when you were young and you had a band, and you bought a sheet music book featuring the music of Harry L. Alford's Hungry Five. This sounds like a really odd little book of sheet music and 22 sets of wisecracks plus additional patter. What was this about? It had wisecracks in it for you to learn?
Well, this was music that Mr. Alford put out, I guess, in the early 50s, and I stumbled upon it by accident. I was rummaging through the local music store, and I was in my high school band, and I was looking for some other kind of band that I could start on my own. And they're funny little arrangements. A lot of it's oom-pah-pah music, waltzes, polkas, and things. And there was actually another book that I found that had more interesting arrangements, that had arrangements of classical tunes, overtures and waltzes. There was the Poet and Peasant Overture, Merry Wives of Windsor, the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies. And there's something kind of nice about this combination of two clarinets, trumpet, trombone, and tuba. It's sort of like taking a concert band and shrinking it to the very smallest essence that you could have. And there's something kind of naive and charming about thinking about this little miniature band trying to play Tchaikovsky or von Suppe. And I like that. So I got some like-minded souls from the high school band, and we used to have rehearsals in the living room, and eventually we had a band, and we got some little gigs and figured out some shtick. I guess the idea of the Hungry Five was that you would play a polka, and then you would tell these horrible jokes, and then play another polka, and we tried doing some of that. The jokes never really went over very well, but they were there.
Did you use jokes from the Harry Alford songbook?
We did. It was jokes like, "I hear your landlord's going to raise your rent." Well, that's good, because I certainly can't raise it. That kind of stuff.
Oh, boy. not good. Were you the one who had to tell the jokes?
Well, we assigned, there were different parts, and, each person took on one of the voices. And when I was writing the liner notes for the album, I was thinking about where this combination of trumpet, trombone, and clarinet came from. It is the front line of a Dixieland band. But I realized that really the way I had gotten the sound into my head was from the old Hungry Five. So I went back and actually, for some reason I'd saved this music, and I looked it up, and there in pencil were all of our phone numbers and little notes between the tunes about who was going to tell which joke and everything. It was all there, and it really took me back.
Who are you performing for then? I mean, this is the era where people had garage bands, not...
Well, we played at some, like, PTA meetings. We played at, parties that our parents were giving.
Are you suggesting that nobody your age wanted to hear the music?
Well, there was one funny thing that happened. I grew up in San Antonio, and there's a big Latino population. And somehow we ended up playing on the talent show for Lanier High School, which was, basically a Mexican-American high school. And we got out there in our lederhosen, and we started playing this polka, and everybody in the audience went wild. I mean, it turns out that polka is a big part of conjunto music, and they related to it in a way that we didn't. And it was suddenly, we thought that we were going to, they'd be throwing tomatoes at us, and they loved it.
My guest is clarinetist and composer Andy Biskin. His new CD is called Dogmental. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andy Biskin. He's a clarinetist and composer, and his new CD, his first, is called Dogmental. Let's hear another track from the CD, and this is called Flim Flam, and I really like it a lot. It's kind of circusy and marching bandish. Let's give it a listen.
Thank you.
Anything in particular inspire that composition?
Well, I think there's some Nina Rota there. There's definitely, I mean, it's sort of a, like a, I think of it as a little miniature film score or something. I'm not sure where it came from. It was one of these tunes that just came to me very quickly. And, you know, I started writing it. I wasn't even sure what key it was in. You know, I said, now I got to write a bass line to it. And I'm still not really sure what key it's in, but, I like the idea of going to this waltz in the middle of it. I had this waltz that I was trying to figure out something to do with, and I thought, well, let's let the song just kind of fall apart and get quiet, and suddenly we'll be in the waltz for a while, and then we'll go back to the march.
Were you in a marching band when you were young?
Oh, yes. In my high school, the music program centered around the marching band. The reason that there was a music program was because it was an adjunct to the football team, So I was out there at 7:30 in the morning during football season marching, and I hated it. I really did. But one thing about the band program is that you get exposed to a lot of different kinds of music, and you know we played a lot of adaptions of classical pieces and these kind of contemporary weird things that people were writing for modern bands and then some of the classics, the Sousa marches. So it was fun, and I think that it was a big influence on me.
Yeah, do you think playing in band gave you an affection for marches that you might otherwise not have had?
Yeah, I have to say, one thing is that, my father was a musician. We were not a family that was into sports, but he would watch football and he would kind of sleep through the game. And when the halftime show came on, he'd turn up the volume. Everyone would have to be silent. And he was into bands. He was into parades. And I think I got some of that from him.
How did clarinet become your instrument? Were you assigned it in school?
Well, it was chosen for me by my parents. And I'm not sure, I didn't have much to do with that decision, but I came home from school one day and there was a clarinet sitting on my bed and my father announced that this was going to be my instrument. And, you know, I said, well, what is it? He said, this is a clarinet. So I accepted that. I was 9 years old. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it sounded. And, you know, soon I was taking lessons from one of the clarinetists in the orchestra working my way through the method books and scales and arpeggios and etudes. But I don't really remember not playing the clarinet. It's something that's always been there.
Did you ever ask your father why he thought clarinet should be your instrument?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't like they had done this in-depth study about it. I think you could buy a clarinet for not much money. They liked the sound of it. It wasn't as annoying as the violin. You could play in the band. You could play in a symphony. There was a good teacher in town. But I think also they thought that it somehow fit my personality.
Now, you have a forthcoming CD that features mostly songs by Stephen Foster. And I'm wondering what it's been like for you to go back to songs from the early days of American popular song and play them and rearrange them.
It's been a really incredible experience. I've been writing my own music for a long time, and I never really have attempted to arrange anybody else's music. I was doing a gig once with a piano player, and we were just leafing through a songbook, and we came upon Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, and we played it, and I said, "Well, this is a beautiful song," and there's something about these tunes. They're like folk songs, except they all happen to be written by the same person. They were all written in the 1860s, and they're so ingrained in our unconscious that you can do so much with them, and they still maintain their identity. I do this version of Old Folks at Home that is a little bit out there, but somehow, you know, the song still comes through.
Did you like Stephen Foster songs as a kid, or did you just consider them to be cliches or old-fashioned?
I did consider them to be cliches, and it was something that I think I really didn't appreciate until I was an adult. But you know, I'm interested in the idea of a musical cliche. That's something that really fascinates me. I have this book called I forgot. It's the Book of World Famous Music by James J. Fould, and it's an incredible book. It's like the canon of every familiar melody that we have in our heads here is in Western civilization. It has everything from, you know, Three Blind Mice, What Do You Say to a Drunken Sailor, plus a lot of classical stuff, Fair Elise, Santa Lucia, For He's a Jolly Good Fellow, Shave and a Haircut, Two Bits. And you think about these things, and they're these melodies that have somehow survived through natural selection or something, that they're just part of our vocabulary, that are just in the air, you know, that everyone knows, and we don't even know why they're there. But if you go bump bump dump bump bump bump, everyone knows that you're referring to Shave and a Haircut, Two Bits.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing too about those old songs that are just kind of in the air, is that whether you like the song or not, there's something that a familiar line of music does to your brain that's just unique. And there's a certain pleasure in familiar music, even familiar music you don't like. So I think even if you as a composer or arranger take a piece of familiar music and you rework it in an unusual way, there's the pleasure a listener has of taking this familiar thing and making it different. But that familiar thing just gives you this common language to work with.
I think that's true, and I think that a lot of what makes a composition interesting is this whole interplay between the familiar and the new. And you know, it works in improvisation, it works in composition, but when you're playing, you're playing with people's expectations. You're giving them things that they know and understand and you know, find comfort in, but you have to keep them stimulated, and there has to be a certain amount of novelty. And I think these tunes are great for that, because everyone knows, you know, they know what's going to happen, but they don't really know how you're going to get there.
Your Stephen Foster CD is recorded, but it's not nearly ready to be released. You're actually still looking for a label to release it on. But maybe we could just play a preview of it. Do you want to choose a song?
Yeah, let's listen to Camptown Races.
And what have you done with this?
I guess it's sort of like a theme in variations. I've basically just worked my way through the tune in two or three different ways, and it has some little twists and turns, and eventually you get to the end.
Well, great. Let's hear it. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been great.